From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, blood and crisis in Ukraine. Scores dead, snipers out. The Congressional Budget Office says raising the minimum wage could cost 500,000 jobs. The director defended his numbers.
I want to be clear that our analysis of the effects of an increase in the minimum wage is completely consistent with the latest thinking in the economics profession.
And Facebook buys an app, WhatsApp, for $19 billion. Mark Zuckerberg.
We think that WhatsApp is on a clear path to have 1 billion people using their product. And services in the world that have 1 billion people using them are all incredibly valuable.
Plus, a crime against humanity charge against North Korea, a controversial verdict in the Loud Music trial in Florida, protests in Venezuela, Thailand, and more. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of National Journal, Ben White of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What is playing out in Ukraine? Can we raise the minimum wage? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us from Washington, Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
From Englewood, New Jersey, Ben White is here, chief economics correspondent for Politico. He writes the Morning Money column there. Ben White, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beattie joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Ben.
Let's go right to Ukraine as we go to air. The news just coming out of a signed deal, it is said, between the opposition that has been so present in the streets there and the government of Viktor Yanukovych under deep fire. Here's an announcement from the president delivered by an aide, Hannah Herman, in Parliament earlier this morning. The Ukraine president saying that he and the opposition have signed an EU brokered deal to end the crisis, interpreted here by the BBC.
The president has asked me to tell you that he will call an early presidential election in Ukraine. The president will also initiate a return to the constitution of 2004 with a redistribution of powers towards a parliamentary republic. The president has also announced the start of forming a government of national trust.
Michael Hirsch, this has been some week in Ukraine. So many dead. Do you see a resolution here? And what is playing out, Michael?
Well, a lot of what is playing out in this months-long back-and-forth series of protests in which Viktor Yanukovych has alternated between imposing greater dictatorial powers and, as he's done just now, appearing to make concessions to the opposition is really, you know, the whole existential future of Ukraine. Will it be more European, more Western, more Russian? You know, if you look at the demographic linguistic map of the Ukraine, it's sort of divided between Ukrainian-speaking pro-Western populace that's in the West and a largely Russian-speaking populace in the East. And what we're seeing now, with a lot of behind-the-scenes maneuvering by the sort of newly activist EU ministers who had been condemned only weeks ago, you know, privately by a U.S. diplomat as basically being fairly useless in this, along with, and this may be the critical factor here, Vladimir Putin, who is Yanukovych's closest ally, apparently making, you know, some moves to get Yanukovych to back down. Putin, of course, is very concerned about his global prestige and image right now with the Sochi Olympics coming to a close. So I think there's a lot of mistrust about whether Yanukovych means what he says here, and there should be. And we have to see how it plays out in the weeks ahead, particularly, you know, after the Sochi Olympics close. And I think we return to a more assertive Vladimir Putin, who has been one of the key figures behind sort of pulling Yanukovych and Ukraine back into his orbit.
Live fire, essentially described as a state of war in the streets of Kiev this week. The death toll was very high, up toward 100. Here's a doctor yesterday, a volunteer medical doctor helping protesters, describing some of the injuries. She saw 13 bodies herself, here, talking to the BBC.
They were killed by very high professionals because they didn't give chance to doctors to help people. The bullets come directly to heart, to neck, to lungs, and almost all people who were brought here. We just were doing emergency, but we have no chance to save their life.
Ben White, I don't know how closely you're following this news coming in now that the Ukrainian parliament has restored the 2004 constitution that has more limits on presidential powers. Of course, the protesters in the streets wanted Yanukovych out. Can you see, Ben White, Moscow, with all of its economic interest in Ukraine, standing by while something emerges that may end up turning it from Russia to the EU?
I have a bit of a difficult time imagining that. I mean, I think Michael's point that the protesters have a very good reason to be skeptical of this is well taken. I think, the demand I was hearing last night was that the president resign and leave the country. This is obviously short of that. And we don't know exactly what he's going to do, when these elections are going to be held, whether that constitution is really going to be readopted. And it's hard to imagine Vladimir Putin allowing his interests and Moscow and Russia's interests to go by the wayside here, particularly after Sochi is over, after the spotlight is off of him a little bit. So I'd say I'm quite skeptical of what has been announced this morning. Obviously, everyone is interested in an end to the violence in the streets and not having any more people die here, but how long the protests will be allayed is a good question, and whether the outcome that's been promised will really be delivered is in question, and if it's not, I would expect to see protests restart.
All of this playing out just across the Black Sea from Sochi, where there were some pretty strange scenes themselves these days, including this one, Cossack militia in Sochi attacking Pussy Riot, the punk group with horse whips on Wednesday, as they tried to stage an impromptu performance under a sign advertising the Sochi Olympics. Jack Beatty, it was like scenes out of some old movie. Cossacks in those wool hats and literally a horse whip taking these young women down, throwing coats over them. You know what happens when the coat's thrown over you? It's not good. Jack, between Ukraine on the one side and what we saw there in Sochi on the other, there was this crackle of Cold War in the air this week. Is that for real or just some kind of a throwback?
Well, there certainly was. In Mexico, the White House, an anonymous source told The Guardian, quote, "We just can't solve everyone else's problems anymore," and that the main task of U.S. foreign policy now was one of, quote, "expectation management." Well, that's the minimalism anonymously. But on the record, maximalism, the president saying, warning the Ukrainian military, don't step in, and then saying there will be, quote, "unspecified consequences if people step over the line." That's infelicitous because, of course, his red line in Syria, the Syrians stepped over it and nothing happened. So, yes, that's Cold War, step over the line talk. And the president has been criticized for not doing enough in Ukraine, for our, too quiet foreign policy. We really have to tap some historical perspective here. I mean, the Eisenhower administration did not do anything when Soviet tanks crushed the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. There are limits, and especially in a country that's in the Russian sphere of influence. I'm just encouraged that, there does seem to be some kind of working politics there. At some level, at least at the level of avowal, the government is responding. The big question is what's going to happen on the Maidan, the square, and will the right-wing parties there and the right-wing people who have been fighting, will they come over? There's a strong nationalist right-wing element to that resistance.
That's been giving physical cover to the pro-European opposition out there.
That's right. Rather like what we saw in Tahrir Square, where you had liberals and members of the Muslim Brotherhood protesting the Mubarak regime.
Michael Hirsch, do you see a way to, split the difference here that gives Ukrainian opposition the reassurance it needs that it can have Ukraine on a path that it would be satisfactory? Maybe that means the European trade deal and the kind of embrace that Moscow wants here at the same time. Can Ukraine have it both ways?
I think it's going to have to, Tom. I mean, just to add a little bit to Jack's perspective and your question about crackles of the Cold War, in some ways, this is the culmination of some two decades of struggle between East and West since the end of the Cold War, as we've seen, for example, NATO moving west, moving eastward and claiming some former Soviet bloc countries. I mean, it's interesting that one of the countries involved in the negotiations over the last few days was Poland.
Yeah.
Obviously, a former Soviet bloc country. You've seen in Putin since his return to power an election originally, you know, a decade ago, a guy who has won a lot of popularity by seeming to restore what used to be the old Soviet sphere. And that's really what a lot of this struggle is about from his point of view. And from the point of view of many Ukrainians who do identify with their so-called fraternal brother, you know, the Russian motherland. On the other hand, you have a lot of these younger Ukrainians, as we said earlier, particularly in the western part of the country, that desperately, you know, yearn to be part of the European Union, to be part of the West. And so you have this spectacle. It has echoes of the Cold War. It also has some echoes of Tiananmen Square in China in 1989, where what began as an economic struggle, an economic protest over joining the EU, has flowered into something much, much larger, again, about the entire future direction of Ukraine. I don't think it's going to be resolved anytime soon.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Ukraine on fire. Facebook buys a $19 billion app. The CBO on minimum wage and jobs. Pussy Riot horsewhipped in Sochi. We're joined today by Ben White, chief economic correspondent for Politico. He writes the Morning Money column there. Michael Hirsch is with us, chief correspondent for National Journal. Jack Beatty's here. Of course, the CBO report saying 500,000 jobs could be lost with a $10.10 minimum wage. Got lots of people talking in Washington and beyond. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said, don't you believe it?
There is not evidence that it has a significant impact on jobs, and that to the contrary, it's beneficial to the economy and to efficiency and productivity. Raising the minimum wage, certainly in the way that has been proposed and the president supports, is the right thing to do for the economy, and that does not have a significant impact on jobs.
So he says, but the White House has been, of course, quick to embrace Congressional Budget Office numbers in the past that supported their agenda. Republicans eager to say and quick to say, look, we can't do business on a higher minimum wage. It will cost jobs. Here's Senator John Thune, Republican, South Dakota, on Morning Joe Wednesday.
A lot of our young people need those types of jobs. They're entry level. Everybody wants to see people come up the economic ladder. Joe, it's kind of economics 101. If you want more of something, you don't normally raise the price. If you want more jobs, you want more employment, you don't raise the price of it.
Ben White, what's the bottom line here on jobs? Is it clear?
No, it's not clear. Anything in economics is never clear. But as you mentioned, the White House, you live by the CBO, die by the CBO. And what they essentially said was they foresee a range of possible job losses under a $10.10 minimum wage, from a negligible number to a million. And they settled on halfway, 500,000, as what they saw as the likely outcome. And there is a wide swath of economic literature that suggests that there will be some job loss involved in raising the minimum wage, because it is economics 101. You raise the price of something, you tend to get a little bit less of it. But there was plenty of good stuff for the administration in that report as well, lifting nearly a million people out of poverty, raising wages for 16 million. So, you know, you sort of take the good with the bad on the minimum wage. I was a little bit surprised, and I had a breakfast with event with Gene Sperling this week, who's leaving the White House, the chief National Economic Council director, and he stayed on this hard line that no net impact on jobs, there won't be job losses. I feel like they sort of have to keep up this stiff line against Republican opposition, but I'm not even sure they really believe it. There are going to be some losses. The question is how many. But the larger argument is it's the fair thing to do. It's the right thing to do. The minimum wage is not kept up anywhere near the rate of inflation, and that you would have a number of economic benefits along with it, along with some job losses. And they do argue, probably correctly, that some of those losses would be mitigated by less absenteeism, harder workers working for a higher wage. So on balance, they can argue that the economic benefits of raising the minimum wage to $10.10 outweigh some of the negative impacts. But it's hard to argue that there wouldn't be any negative impacts, because I think most economists agree that there would be some. So the fact that they're saying we see zero job losses is somewhat surprising to me, but I feel like they kind of have to take that hard line because Republicans are going to be so opposed to any increase in the minimum wage.
Jack, practical and political headwind for the White House in this CBO estimate.
Oh, indeed. You know, you can almost ask, has Obama lost the CBO? As you intimated on Obamacare, good news there. It cuts the deficit. The CBO said stimulus created jobs, immigration be a boon to the economy. All these things the White House has been able to point and say, we've got the facts on our side. But now, just to quote the New York Times lead, for the second time in as many weeks, the White House on Tuesday found itself racing to contain the political fallout from a potentially damaging report from the CBO. Last week's report, of course, was about the Obamacare having the effect of reducing the total number of hours worked. And in both cases, these have been gifts to Republican, buttressing, really, Republican talking points at the worst time for the president.
Let's bring our listeners in here. Don in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Don, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My thought is they should raise the minimum wage up, and then after this time, tie it into raises for politicians, either federally or in the state. That way, when the people at the top get a raise, the people at the bottom get a raise, and not percentage-wise, everybody, if it's a penny raise or a dollar raise, they get the same thing.
So link it to something that's going up, an index or politicians' wages. What about the argument, Don, though, that if you raise it, there may be fewer jobs out there as a result in the end?
They said there'd be fewer jobs, but then they also said that there's a good thing, that there's a good chance that it could create almost a million jobs.
If I could...
Yes,
that,
Ben.
Just a minute. Mm-hmm. There is the question. We saw Walmart this week flirting with the idea of raising its wages.
Yeah.
Gap has unilaterally decided to raise its minimum wage. In terms of creating jobs, I mean, you certainly will have people with more money in their pockets, mm-hmm. more purchasing power. So if you saw an initial loss in jobs at the low end, whether retailers, fast food restaurants, the types of places that tend to pay the minimum wage may cut jobs initially, then see a whole large group of people who make the minimum wage having a little bit more money to spend at, you know, at McDonald's, at the Gap, at Walmart. They're going to need to rehire folks to serve those people. So, you know, you can't argue that there would be an initial loss of jobs when the number moves up that would then be reversed by the increased purchasing power of those earning the minimum wage. So the White House hasn't quite made that argument, but they probably should.
Michael Hirsch, do you see this hike in the minimum wage coming about? Do you see the GOP sticking with its tough criticism as we head toward the polls midterm in the fall?
Oh, undoubtedly, and heightening that criticism as we head into the 2014 election. The larger context here, I think, Tom, is that this is about a trade-off, as it always is in economics, as Ben said. There's probably going to be some loss of jobs, but Obama is betting that with the unemployment rate declining, the nation will be more focused and should be more focused on what he's called the defining challenge of our time, which is income inequality. And of course, the trade-off here is perhaps you do lose some jobs, but you lift 900,000 or so people out of poverty and do your bit to close that widening income gap that has many economists very concerned. And so, again, the trade-off is you lose a little on one side, but you gain more on what the president himself has identified as the critical issue.
We'll see how that plays as we get closer to the election. I mean, I don't know. If the GOP wants some of those low-wage voters, it may be tough to argue against it, but that's the challenge. I want to turn to North Korea, if we may, for a moment. Scathing, deeply critical report from the United Nations talking about unspeakable atrocities in North Korea. Crimes against humanity came out this week. Investigators in Geneva releasing this report. The press conference in Geneva, chairman of the UN panel, Michael Kirby, called for justice, compared the crimes in North Korea to atrocities committed by the Nazis.
The witnesses in one of the camps told of how his duties included gathering up the bodies of those who had died of starvation, putting them in a pot and burning them, and then taking the ashes, but sadly also the remnant of unburned human bodies, and then burying that in nearby fields where it proved to be very good fertilizer.
Gruesome report on North Korea, and that was just one angle. There, just element after element that was hair-raising. They went on again to compare this to the atrocities under the Nazis and say, he said, there will be no excusing a failure of action because we didn't know. We do know. Michael Hirsch, we kind of assume that North Korea is a terrible place. As bad as this report is, does it bring on any action, or is it immediately back to sort of status quo? It's their own hermit kingdom, and we don't get engaged.
No, I think this is an important and even historic report, Tom, mm-hmm. in that, yes, you're right. It only sort of confirms what many people who study North Korea have been saying for years. This is an appalling gulag state, indeed, in many respects, the only true Stalinist totalitarian state left in the world. And has been absolutely brutal to its population, as we've been hearing from defectors for years. But the fact that this has been set down in print in a 400-page report, mm-hmm. That there's been and there is a threat to refer this and refer to the North Korean regime to the International Criminal Court in The Hague is an important move. Why? Because it forces the hand of North Korea's main ally, China, and puts China in a very difficult position. China has already criticized this report, but meanwhile, China does not really want to be the lone power on the UN Security Council vetoing a referral to the ICC. And so for the first time in a very official way, this raises the Kim regime's appalling human rights record to the level of international diplomacy. You know, it's kind of been set aside. There have just been deals struck on and off with the North Korean regime over the years over its nuclear program. This brings human rights back to front and center, where, you know, frankly, many people think it belongs.
Jack, it's interesting when terrors that we've become inured to and kind of come to have accepted and exempted North Korea from active criticism because, well, that's North Korea.
Yes.
When the scab is pulled off and you look at it, it's hard to just sit by. On the other hand, how did the geopolitics really change here that would allow some kind of intervention? I mean, you've still got the same frozen boundaries and geopolitics.
Yes, and a state in arms, really, and completely a population completely propagandized for a generation and more. You know, over yesterday or 2 days ago, a man named Vern Ehlers died. He was the last D-Day Medal of Honor winner, won the Medal of Honor on D-Day. And, of course, that was the liberation of France. And in his autobiography, Jean-Paul Sartre, who was, of course, in France then, recalls when the Nazis invaded Russia, Soviet Union, and then the Americans came in later in 1941, everyone realized liberation would happen. Evil would not have the last word. It couldn't hold out against the United States and the Soviet Union. And then he wondered aloud, he said, what would happen in a world in which the concept of liberation doesn't exist? Well, that's our world. I mean, the world where evil, North Korea, Syria, can triumph again and again and again, and triumph not because the world doesn't know what's happening there, mm-hmm. but because we do, and we don't want to pay the price of delivering the innocent from evil.
I mean, there was a time, it's really interesting. Michael Hirsch, there was a time when, at least in the narrative we told about the world, everybody saw liberation somewhere. They may have seen it in Western forces, you know, bringing freedom. They may have seen it in, you know, communist liberation, but liberation was the word. Now we've got all these sort of settled conflicts without any prospect of liberation or some, you know, marvelous future on the horizon.
Yeah, there's an odd mix of democracy movements in some countries, repression, renewed repression in others, like China, like Russia. Obviously, North Korea has been a steady state of absolutely brutal repression to the point where, you know, there's almost no dissent detectable. And when dissent does come out, people get sent to these horrific gulags. And it's difficult to discern any particular, you know, theme here. I do think if you look at the protests that are occurring in places like Ukraine, Venezuela, Thailand. There is a common theme, which is the corruption, rampant mm-hmm. corruption in some of these governments. If you look at the particulars, you know, of what's motivating the protesters, it's often outrage at overreaching governments that are lining their pockets with graft. And we've seen also repression of democracy, as I said, places like Egypt in the aftermath of the Arab Spring. So there's not a real discernible trend here, but an awful lot of ferment.
Ben White, you know, the political battle lines of the Cold War at least had a simple narrative. When it's corruption and the power that comes with that, harder to fight, harder to see where the liberation lies, Ben.
It is much harder to see, and they are disparate situations, obviously. But the impetus behind most of the protests being a desire for freedom and for more representative government and less repression. But they are all very different situations, North Korea obviously being the most horrific. And I do agree that this report is important in that, once again, highlights the level of atrocity that's going on there. I don't know that it necessarily means that anything happens in the near term, but it can't be anything but helpful in terms of raising the profile, putting the pressure on China, isolating them more on their support of North Korea. But all of this also highlights difficulties for the Obama administration in that there is a limited amount of things they can do, pressure they can bring to bear, and it does highlight again the Syrian declaration of don't cross this red line. That red line got crossed and nothing happened. And in Ukraine, I think they'll be very thankful if this announcement today can lead to an end to this clash in the square and the death of protesters, because it is embarrassing to the administration that there's not much that they can do, that they don't have a clearly delineated policy mm-hmm. there.
They don't pick up the phone when we call, Washington was saying this week.
Yeah, well, there is that, that's not particularly helpful. And you know, I have great sympathy with the administration for the lack of options on the table there and limited influence that's brought to bear. But they will be criticized for it, and it will bring up the Syrian problem that they had. And I think they would much rather focus on domestic issues that we've been talking about earlier and the midterm elections and economic inequality and less focus on the international scene where they've had some significant problems.
A quick call before the break here. John in Niagara Falls, New York. John, you're on the air. What are you thinking about?
What am I thinking about? I'm thinking about everything that you gentlemen are speaking of, but I think we're kind of missing the point here. The people in these other countries, Egypt, Tunisia, all these other places, Kiev, they want their freedom because they're a little bit younger and a hell of a lot more educated. They know that they're getting robbed, and they want at least just that economic break to come up. There seems to be this corruption factor even here in the United States. So when it comes here, what are they going to do? They want to raise the minimum wage, but we have a bunch of millionaires in Congress, both Democrat and Republicans. We're saying, oh, I don't think so, because they're being decked, and they have to process so much time raising funds for re-election.
If you start talking about corruption, look all over you, say John, and when people in the States are told you can't have a $10.10 minimum wage, well, they might like a little liberation from that economic box. Point taken. I appreciate your call, John. We're right up against a break here. Come back and look at that and much more when we return. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a tough, tough U.S. women's hockey loss to Canada in Sochi. It all happened so fast. Team captain Megan Duggan.
I looked over at one of our goaltenders. I said, there's no way they're going to score, you know, two goals on Vets. She's hot right now, and she's an outstanding goaltender. I think, you know, you get a couple bounces, they're swarming around the net, and pucks go in.
Pucks go in, and no joy for the U.S. team, but still a silver medal there. The co-pilot of an Ethiopian Airlines flight to Rome seized control and flew to Switzerland, seeking asylum. Here's the tape with the tower in Geneva.
We're still trying to have a response from the Swiss authorities about your request. It's hard because everybody was sleeping, so we are trying to get this as soon as possible.
Thank you.
That's one way to do it. And Jimmy Fallon took over NBC's The Tonight Show.
And now, here's your host, Jimmy
We're looking at a week in the news. Ukraine on fire. Facebook buys a $19 billion app. The CBO on minimum wage and jobs with Ben White, chief economics correspondent for Politico. Michael Hirsch is chief correspondent for National Journal with us from Washington. Jack Beatty's here. Plenty of trouble in Venezuela as well this week. Much closer to home. Huge demonstrations there. Demonstrators faced off with the security forces in streets blocked by burning barricades in several cities. Escalating protests against the president, Nicolas Maduro's government. Here's the sound from Caracas. It was rough in Caracas, and we're told all over. Sergio's calling from Stanton, Virginia. Sergio, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The point I just wanted to make was that with all the turmoil and everything that's going on in Venezuela, with my wife actually being from that country and very little done, little action done, by the U.S.
Sergio, does your wife support the socialist government there in Venezuela, or is she opposed to it?
She is actually opposed to it. She does not like Maduro and the way he's running things. And one of the things that I really thought was very interesting was that there was a report that Maduro is not even a Venezuelan. He is actually a Colombian-born citizen in Colombia.
Well, yeah, okay. I mean, we know how those things go, but they've got real problems in their economy. Does she go back or not, Sergio? Does she go back to Venezuela?
We haven't been there in 3 years. The last time we've been there was in 3 years ago, but yep. We haven't been back since.
Sergio, I appreciate your call. Michael Hirsch, here's another, this much nearer setting with a lot of turmoil this week. And again, you wonder about the U.S. role. Is there one in Venezuela, or are we on the sidelines watching this? Is that where we should be, Michael?
Well, yeah, I think so. Clearly, U.S. resources and attention are limited. And for the past 15 years or so, before Hugo Chavez died, we've been on the receiving end of his anti-American rhetoric, attempted to respond, but not with really any attempt to influence the political outcome there. I think what you have now here in the wake of Chavez's death from cancer is a would-be mini Chavez who's not quite succeeding at that. That is President Maduro, who does not have Chavez's charisma, a mastery of the political process, and because Venezuela's economy, and you've got to remember this is an oil-rich country in desperate economic shape, because the economy is doing badly and because there's the perception of a lot of corruption in government, has elicited more popular protests.
And they have spread, we're told, all the way to the Colombian border. A verdict in the last week in the shooting case in Florida on Saturday, Michael Dunn, the Florida man who shot teenager Jordan Davis to death in a parking lot in the dispute over loud music, found guilty on 3 counts of second-degree attempted murder for shooting at other teenagers, but a mistrial on the first-degree murder charge itself. On Wednesday, Jordan Davis's parents spoke to Byron Pitts of ABC News Nightline. Here's his mother, Lucia McBath.
I know this sounds really harsh, but I have likened what's happened with the laws as legal lynching.
Those are strong words. More than 6,000 African-American men were lynched in this country.
The Stand Your Ground laws open up a can of worms for people based upon a perception to legally be gunned down.
They opened up some acid humor this week as well. On The Daily Show on Tuesday, comedian correspondent Jessica Williams responded to the Michael Dunn trial and verdict with this skit.
I've come up with a new curriculum for Black History Month. Forget all that George Washington Carver peanut crap. Black kids need life lessons they can actually use.
Like what? What would you do?
Okay. Number one, kids, stay in school.
Well, that's good. That's good advice for anybody.
By which I mean, if you're at school, stay in the building. If you're at home, stay at home. Don't go wander into the street where you might scare a white person.
Ben White, that is tough language from Jordan Davis's mother. One can understand her grief, but she's looking at the Stand Your Ground laws, and she's describing it as legal lynching. How does that hit your ear, Ben?
It is very strong words, and one can certainly understand them coming from grieving parents, but it raises a very, I think, legitimate point with these stand your ground laws. They're enormously problematic, as we obviously saw in the Trayvon Martin case. We've seen here and elsewhere in that they open up this area where someone who feels threatened in some way by someone who might not be of their race or ethnicity can take some action that may not be justified and wind up in tragic circumstances, and then leave a jury, as in this case on the first-degree murder charge, in a very gray area, trying to decide whether there was self-defense involved in a situation where somebody is shooting into an SUV even as it departs. I think the circumstances of this case are tragic. All of them are tragic. You never want any of them to happen, but as they open up this dialogue about the efficacy and usefulness of these laws, something good could come from them in that they may need to be rethought and, in fact, perhaps taken off the books. I do not think they are serving the purpose that they were meant to serve, and I think you'll see a lot of discussion in the years to come about repealing some of these laws.
When you get this drumbeat, I mean, Trayvon Martin, okay, but here, loud music, okay, but shooting even as the SUV left the scene, and stand your ground, the jury getting gummed up right there. Jerry in Berlin, New Hampshire. Jerry, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have a quick question. I was curious, why was second or even third degree murder not considered in the Michael Bunn case? And I'll take the response on air.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. You're beyond my legal pay grade there. Michael, Jack, I have no idea why it was first degree murder laid down, except that it was a straightforward situation in one way. You had a young man in an SUV, unarmed, shot, dead. Maybe that's it, Michael or Jack. Just, it looks like first degree.
Well, one thing that's a little bit bizarre is the jury found Dunn guilty of attempted murder charges. Remember, he's actually been found guilty of charges that could bring him up to 60 years in prison.
It's not like he's not going to jail.
Exactly. So it's not like it's not like the George Zimmerman case in that respect. But what was truly odd was that, you know, having found him guilty of attempted murder, they didn't find him guilty of murder of any degree.
So in other words, it was the firing on the other passengers in the SUV that was ruled on here, not the poor dead young man.
Right, right. Very strange.
Let me go to Jeff in Dothan, Alabama. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
I just wanted to agree with the previous speaker and to emphasize the fact that this involves, in each case, the Michael Dunn and the Trayvon Martin case, the provoking of a child into an unnecessary response from an adult. And I see that as amazingly problematic.
I guess Michael Dunn would say he was provoked here, but come on, provoked doesn't mean you can just fire off your pistol in every direction. No problem. Appreciate your call, Jeff. Let me get one right here from Brewstertown, Tennessee. Terry's calling. Terry, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thanks.
Hi.
Do you think the water leak and water contamination up in the tar sands is going to convince people that the oil industry is right about the Keystone Pipeline and all these other leaks and deaths that have come about?
What, are you talking the oil industry's claim that it's safer in a pipeline than on rail transportation, or what's your perspective, Terry?
Well, 48 people died in that town with Bakken oil explosion, so that doesn't. But there, the TransCanada has had several leaks, including in Yellowstone River.
Terry, again, you're a little beyond the news that I'm on top of there. I've not heard all of that. I do know that this week we had a judicial ruling that could get in the way of Keystone XL. This was a judge in Nebraska who issued a ruling invalidating an approval of the route by the Nebraska Governor Dan Heineman. And so XL's got another challenge in its teeth. Ben White, we had President Obama this week meeting the three amigos with the leaders of Canada and Mexico. XL very much on the agenda there. Canada wants it badly. What about what we see as dangers from different styles of transportation here and where President Obama may be leaning, Ben?
Yeah, I think he's leaning ultimately against it personally. You see that every time a report comes out from the State Department or somewhere else playing down the environmental impacts, he tends to push back on that. I think you mentioned the Nebraska ruling. That's important in that it may delay a final decision by the administration, which I think is actually what they want. I don't think they want to make a call on this. They don't want to be seen as preventing the creation of at least some jobs for the creation of the pipeline, obviously very few when it's up and running. I think they'd like to run out the clock on it if there's any way that they can do that, so not to anger environmentalists who oppose it and not to be seen as anti-economic growth.
But what does run out the clock mean? Just on their term in office, you mean, Ben?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously he's got a ways to go, but that you know, people will eventually give up on it. Or I think that the pipeline folks in Canada will decide on another alternative. They'll be sick of waiting and figure out another way to do it. But that brings up your caller's point. Is that way going to be less safe and more damaging to the environment with these leaks and spills? But that applies to pipelines as well. But I do think the ultimate outcome that the administration wants is for it to go away and for TransCanada to decide that they'll ship this tar sands oil another way.
A lot of people saying it's not going away one way or another. Ben, Jack, what do you think?
Well, I was just going to say it got a little harder for the president this week. Dr. Marcia McNutt, the editor-in-chief of Science Magazine, came out with an editorial. David Green interviewed her this morning on Morning Edition. And she, a former member of the in the Obama administration with the Geological Survey, she comes out and said, "No, I've changed my view. We have to whether the pipeline goes in or not, that isn't going to affect the fact that the oil will come out of the ground. That's the dangerous thing. So let's have the pipeline go through and let's figure out some way." I think she was talking about taxes or somehow regulation to cream some money out of that can go into supporting alternative fuels.
They've got an editorial coming out saying that the pipeline will be less damaging to the environment than the, quote, viable alternatives of oil, transporting oil by rail or truck, and the editor at the journal Science saying maybe it ought to be made conditional on Canada's agreeing to reduce its oil industry's carbon emissions. Of course, that's hard to do when you're doing tar sands development, but really interesting to see where that conversation on tar sands and the pipeline go over time. Ben White, take us to one more very big business deal this week, the Facebook $19 billion purchase of WhatsApp, famously with just, 55 employees. Something like that. How we heard Mark Zuckerberg at the top of the hour saying if they've got $1 billion, a billion users, they're worth a lot of money. 19 billion, Ben?
Yeah, it's an eye-popping number, but when he puts it that way, you can start to see why it might make some sense for them to do it. And I would say those are 55 very wealthy employees right now, and we're all in the wrong business is the conclusion I draw from that. But the point is that this is a very popular messaging app. The numbers are exploding in terms of people who use it to send texts across different platforms. This is the way current generation communicates. It's not phone calls. It's text messages. And if you get a billion users, even if right now they charge, they're free for the first year, $1 for the second year to use their service. Not a lot of money. But ultimately, that will increase some. And if you've got a billion folks using a messaging device, even paying a nominal amount per year, that's a huge amount of money down the road, a huge amount of revenue that would dwarf $19 billion. So on first blush, looks like a ridiculous number for an app that a lot of people in our generation or my generation might not necessarily have heard of, but that younger people use a lot. I think long term, the bet is, A, keep it away from Google. Don't want them to get it, outbid them, and then make revenue off it a few years down the road. If a billion people are using it, that's a lot of money.
Michael Hirsch, good on them for their innovation. But here's another one of these moments where people out there dreaming of a $10.10 an hour minimum wage look at $19 billion and think, what's going on with the economy here? The way things get spread around or don't.
Right. Well, the very, very rich just got a little richer. At least those 55 employees did. I think this is also about, frankly, the idea, and Mark Zuckerberg is well aware of this, has thought about it since the very beginnings of Facebook, that for younger people, Facebook is becoming a little bit uncool. It's too public, too much advertising. WhatsApp and other applications like it that emphasize privacy are sort of taking off in this new economy. And I would not be surprised if that was foremost on Zuckerberg's mind. But yes, to get back to your question, this is another economy that's orbiting way above the one that's inhabited by most of the rest of us.
So we've got to contend with that. on the world stage, Jack, I still have that image in my mind's eye of the Cossack with the horse whip and those, what, three, four, five young women in their neon bright costumes, Pussy Riot there in Sochi. I never thought in 2014 I'd see a horse whip coming down on a woman's back anywhere, Jack.
It really just shows the strain of, and of course he's an American sounding off, but the strain of sort of Russian nationalist primitivism that's part of this Putin apparatus. You know, it was just 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, that Cossacks led a pogrom in Kiev, of all places, that killed hundreds of Jews. They're a symbol of reaction and brutality. And to have them out there, to have those optics, think of that. I mean, what... You know, from all other points of view, what a terrible public relations moment.
$50 billion spent on Sochi as a celebration coming out party. You get a 2-minute video of that reality, and people will remember. Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being with us this hour. Always great to have you right here.
Thank you.
Ben White, chief economic correspondent for Politico, writes the Morning Money column there. Ben, thank you very much for joining us today.
Great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Michael Hirsch, chief correspondent for National Journal, joining us today from Washington. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.